Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jane Donahue. Today we kick off our annual broadcast of presentations from the College of the Atlantic Summer Institute in Bar Harbor, Maine. Every year, the College of the Atlantic Summer Institute invites speakers to address a topic relevant to our times. This year's theme was Pathbreaking: Pioneers, Innovators, Leaders. Today's episode is the first in a six-part series. Episodes will air Monday through Thursday and pick back up again next Monday. Today, David Rubenstein reflects on his unconventional path from law student to private equity mogul with author and literary director of the Library of Congress, Marie Arana. Together, the two explore what makes a great leader and what allows for a fulfilling life. This talk was recorded live on July 29, 2025, and has been edited for broadcast.
David, my first question is the origin of your interest in culture, because you have devoted all of your philanthropy to the American culture. And that goes all the way from monuments to literature, to literacy, to libraries, to recovering the history that we have. So how did this start for you? Tell us your origin story.
I'm not sure it's going to be that interesting, but what happened, I'm from a blue-collar family in Baltimore. My parents dropped out of high school to get married. My father came back from World War II. I was their only child. And Baltimore is very rigidly segregated when I was growing up, because if you were black or Jewish, you couldn't live in most areas of Baltimore. You had to live in very narrow areas. So I didn't know anybody who wasn't Jewish until I was like 13. I thought everybody in the world was Jewish, and I realized most people are not Jewish. But it was a very blue-collar environment. And then one day, something big happened in my near my neighborhood. A man who was running for president of the United States was going to drive by. And his name was John F. Kennedy. And I, wow, I'm going to meet John F. Kennedy. So I didn't know if I could really meet him. But I went out there. I was probably in the sixth or seventh grade. And he drove by, he was campaigning for president, and he was waving at everybody. I thought he was waving at me. And so I was inspired to kind of want to work in the government, because in those days, when you're growing up in Baltimore and you're a blue-collar family, my parents didn't graduate from high school. They never thought about going to college. I just wanted to get an education and go into government and serve the country in that way. I didn't think I could be a candidate and have the charm, the good looks, the money to be Kennedy. I thought I'd be an advisor. My role model was Ted Sorensen, who was the man who wrote these great speeches that Kennedy worked on as well. But the great speeches were written by Sorensen. He was the intellectual blood bank for President Kennedy. And so I went to work at that law firm for a while that he was at after I graduated from law school. And I just, in those days, you didn't aspire to be a private equity person, a hedge fund person. That didn't exist. I just wanted to work in government, be an advisor to a president like Ted Sorensen, and that's basically was it. And I got lucky. I went to work for a man who was running for president that Ted Sorensen helped me get a job with. He was really qualified for president. He was the chairman of a lot of committees in the Senate. His name was Birch Bayh. Some of you may remember him. 1976, I was his chief counsel. And 30 days after I joined his operation, he dropped out. And I don't know if any of you had a bad experience like this before, but I thought I was out of work. I'm working for a man I thought would be president. I'd be in the White House like Ted Sorensen, and all of a sudden, didn't happen. So I got a call out of the blue from a man who said, "Would you like to work for somebody else running for president? Who would that be?" Jimmy Carter. I said, "That's the peanut farmer from Georgia, right? He's never going to be president." And they said, "Well, he might not, but you don't have a job. Why don't you interview?" So, so I interviewed. I got the job, and then I went to work in Atlanta. And Carter reminded me after the election that he was 34 points ahead before I joined, and he won by 1 point. And he kind of said, like, "What was your real contribution?" So, but I got a job. You know, as we all have observed recently and in many years past, White House staffs are filled not on merit, but who worked in the campaign. So I worked in the campaign. I'm 27 years old. I'm 3 years out of law school, and I'm the deputy domestic policy advisor to the President of the United States. I didn't know anything about domestic policy, nor needed Carter. So I managed to get inflation to 19%, which was hard to do. And but I remember telling President Carter, "You have no chance of losing this election to Ronald Reagan. He's 69 years old. Nobody that old can get out of bed in the morning. I'm now older than that. So 69 seems to me like a teenager, but then I seem like an old man. I didn't think Reagan could win. And then some of you may have had the same experience. People came to me all the time and said, you're in the White House, you're a really smart guy, you want a job, call me. And then, of course, I didn't want to leave the White House. I wanted to be in the second Carter term. Well, then what happened was we lost the election. I called all these people, said, you know, I'm the bright young man you wanted to hire, and they've never called me back, never called back. And so I didn't get a job for a long time, and you know, I didn't want to tell my mother her only job was unemployable, so I kept saying I had so many offers, I didn't know which one to take. And finally, she figured out I didn't have any offers. Then I went back and practiced law, and I realized I wasn't that good at that, and so I did something else. But what happened was it happened by serendipity. To answer your question, serendipity. You live in Washington. You see all the monuments and the memorials, and, you know, you get close to them. And one time, somebody invited me to go to a viewing of a document called the Magna Carta. And I wasn't that involved in English history, but I knew that it was the inspiration for the Declaration of Independence. So I went to view it, and it turned out it was for sale. Ross Perot had bought it. It's the only copy in private hands, and for whatever reason, he was going to sell it. And the curator at Sotheby's said, very cleverly, you know, it's going to go to somebody from Russia or Saudi Arabia or other people she knew was going to bid on it. It may leave the United States. It's the only one in private hands, the only one in the United States. So I said, okay, I'll try to buy it. And so the next night, I didn't want to tell anybody. It sounds presumptuous to say they're going to buy the Magna Carta. So I didn't tell anybody. But the next night, I went there. I go to this auction. I'd never been to Sotheby's before. And all of a sudden, I'm in there, and they put me in a little room. And they start bidding, and I'm listening, people are bidding, and I didn't bid. And the person on the phone says, well, aren't gonna bid? And I said, well, I don't know, maybe it's pretty expensive, I don't know. And she said, well, you better bid soon. So I put in one bid, and all of a sudden they said, sold. So I don't know if anybody else actually bid. So then when I bought it, I said, look, I wanna give back to the country. I'm gonna give this to the country as a down payment on my obligation to give back. It's now in the National Archives. And it just led me to buy other historic documents. And then ultimately, when the Washington Monument has earthquake damage, I offered to fix it up. And the head of the Park Service said, well, that's great, because Congress will take a couple years to give us the money. Then Congress saw that you know, fixing the Washington Monument was a favorable thing. They said, can they put in some money? So they did as well. But I realized, and this is the point of it, when you have historic documents and historic buildings, the Washington Monument, the Custis Lee Mansion, the Mount Vernon, Montpelier, Monticello. What's the point of preserving them? Why preserve these historic documents? We know what's in the Declaration of Independence. We can put it on a computer slide. We know what the Washington Monument looks like, so if it falls apart, who cares? The reason is this. The human brain has not yet evolved to the point that seeing something on a computer slide is the same as seeing it in person. So when you see something in person, the Magna Carta, the Declaration of Independence, you're more likely to read about it before you go there. You're more likely to have a curator explain it to you when you're there, and you're more likely to read about it afterwards. And that helps you understand more about the history of the country. And the reason that's important is most people today don't know much about the history of this country. We don't teach history very much anymore. When I was in college, the average college had about 9% of history majors. Now it's about 1.5%. Because everybody wants to be a computer science major or a STEM major so you can get a job at Google or Goldman Sachs or something like that. And so there are no more history majors, and the result is we don't know much about our history. And the final point, it's hard for me to believe this, but is anybody here is a naturalized American? Anybody a naturalized American? Okay. If to be a naturalized American, you have to take a citizenship test. 5 years residence, you take a test. Tests are things like who's the first president of the United States, who was the president during the Civil War, things like that. Not the hardest test. 91% of the people who take this test pass. 91% of the naturalized citizen applicants pass. The same test was given to people born in this country in all 50 states. And about 3 years ago, 3.5 million people took it, and only one state, Vermont, could a bare majority pass. So in 49 out of 50 states, people born in this country couldn't pass the basic civics test that you have to take to be a citizen. So we're really in danger of not learning our history. And the reason that's a problem is if you don't remember history, you're gonna make the same mistakes that were made before. That's why I try to preserve documents. That's why I try to remind people of the importance of learning how our country works and our history. And that's the point of the whole thing.
Absolutely, well, yeah, wonderful. So David, you've just taken us on a fast express trip from working class Baltimore to buying the Magna Carta and recovering the monuments. So speaking of, I mean, you've lived the American dream. There's no question about it. And everybody who lives the American dream is a pathbreaker in his and or her own right. very important aspect of being an American. But I want to take you
well,
back.
Because the American dream as well, right?
Would you say? I've lived the American dream
because
as well.
The American dream was a phrase invented by a writer in 1931 or two. And it meant you could come in this country or you'd be in this country and you could rise up by the hard work and so forth. It turns out, sadly, that most Americans today, certainly those in the lower socioeconomic classes, don't believe in the American dream. The American dream is believed in more by people that came, like you did, from another country. And that's we have 50 million immigrants in this country, and many of them are some of our most talented citizens. And they're the people that, you know, Albert Einstein was an immigrant, Henry Kissinger was an immigrant, Madeleine Albright was an immigrant. We have so many great people, and yet we treat foreigners sometimes with disdain, unfortunately, but they believe in the American dream, and sadly, many people born in this country today have lost the view that the American dream is realistic for them.
That's very true. That's very true. But I want you to recount for the young people who are listening and are in the audience or on live stream, how did you get there from a boy who was walking to the Enoch Pratt Library and then moving on to being the best kid in your school to Duke, to the University of Chicago? And how did the building of the American dream?
A lot of luck. I have a theory that in life, you live your life in thirds. The first third, you're getting educated, prepared for the rest of your career. Second third, you're in the middle of your career, you're accomplishing something. And in the third third, you kind of can rest on your laurels a bit or retire a bit or watch your grandchildren or so forth. In the first third of life, the people that win the first third of life, I didn't do that. I wasn't a Rhodes Scholar. I wasn't a Supreme Court clerk. I wasn't anything great. Nobody thought I would accomplish anything. In fact, in my college class, I don't think anybody even knew I was in the class. I was nothing. And very often, the people in the first third, they're so talented, they get so many awards that they kind of coast the second third. And so while the people that were the Rhodes Scholars and the Supreme Court clerks in my generation, they coasted. And I was just still like the tortoise and the hare. I was still working because I realized I wasn't as smart as the others, gifted as the others. I had to work harder, and I just got lucky in life and so forth. And, you know, I just got lucky, and I just kept working hard. I never had the view that I was that smart, and therefore I would have to work harder than other people. And, you know, my parents, you know, they didn't know what to make of me because they were blue-collar workers. They didn't discourage me, but my mother would have been happy if I'd done the same thing my father had done, working the post office. So I just felt I wanted to make something with my life. And in the end, as all of you, you know, some of you look like you're my age or younger, around my age, you know, what is life all about? The purpose of life, we don't really know how we got here, but presumably the purpose is, as Jefferson said, for the pursuit of happiness. And how do you get happiness? The greatest happiness in life comes from pursuing something that helps other people. And, you know, when you give back to society, you're going to make yourself happier, in my view. So, you know, there are a lot of tortured billionaires that I know. They've got gigantic bank accounts, but they don't give away any money. They don't help any people. They're going to die very unhappy. The people that are the happiest are the people that are giving away money, giving away their time, giving back to society. And so I just analyzed that I would be happier and have a more fulfilling life if I did this. And, you know, what could be better in life than making your parents proud? So I'm my parents' only child. They lived long enough to see some of what I'd done. Now, your children's more complicated. No child will ever say they're proud of their parents, right? I have three children. They all are well-educated. And, when I got the Presidential Medal of Freedom, they came to the ceremony because Magic Johnson was there, and he was getting it. And I think that they really wanted to meet Magic Johnson. I don't think they would have come otherwise. So, children are never going to be that proud of your parents. And, you know, all the things I've bought now, these historic books and documents and artwork I have, I know my kids say, look, if you don't give it away before you die, we're going to sell it right away. So they're not interested in any of the things. But, you know, that's life. How many of you here have children that are, you would say, you're proud of what they've done? Okay? How many of you would have your children say to you, they're proud of what you've done? Fewer hands. Okay, well, you know the feeling then. Okay.
So David, my next question to you is really about your career, because here you went from studying law to being a lawyer to working in the White House to then working in a law firm again and then leaping to the financial world. How was that trajectory for you?
Well, I always wanted to be a lawyer because I wasn't good at science subjects. So if you were Jewish, you were going to be a doctor, a lawyer, or a dentist. My mother wanted me to be a dentist. She said, look, you can be called a doctor. You don't have any weekend hours. It's a great profession. But I kept saying to my mother, I might get arthritis in my fingers, and then what would I do? So I talked myself out of that one, and I didn't really do that well in science courses, so I thought I'd be a lawyer. And in those days, that was a respectable profession, still is, but despite what Shakespeare said. What happened was this. Most things in life that happen to people happen by serendipity. If I had said to McKinsey, tell me how I can give back to the country, they wouldn't have said, buy the Magna Carta, fix the Washington Monument. It happened by serendipity. What actually happened was I was practicing law, and to do anything great in life, you have to really love what you're doing. Nobody ever won a Nobel Prize hating what they do. If you hate what you do, you're not going to win a Nobel Prize. And I was practicing law, and I hated it. And my clients reminded me I wasn't that good at it, and they were right. So what happened was I read about a man who had been in the Treasury Secretary under President Ford. His name was Bill Simon. And he was a man who did what's called a leverage buyout. Now, a true leverage buyout in those days in the 1980s, you put down 1% of the equity and you borrowed 99% of the purchase price. And if the economy works out and things work out well, you're going to make a lot of money because you're highly leveraged. If it doesn't work out, you'll go bankrupt. He put in $1 million buying Gibson greeting cards, and he made $80 million in 18 months. And I read about that, and I said, I like that better than practicing law. So I have to figure out what it is, a leverage buyout, and I have to figure it out. So I went to a couple people who knew more about finance than I did. I didn't know anything. And I said, why don't you come together? We're going to start a leverage buyout firm in Washington. Why Washington? Because I'm there. And, if I'd gone to New York, I didn't have any investment banking background, people would have laughed even more than they did in Washington. But I always remember what Everett Dirksen, a former Senate Minority Leader, said. When you're getting kicked out of town, get out in front and pretend you're leading a parade. Now, in other words, take advantage of the situation you find yourself in. I'm in Washington, so I'm not going to New York, so I can say, look, I understand companies heavily affected by the federal government, like defense or telecommunications, better than the guys in New York. And so we started a firm, and I didn't really have a lot of value to add, so I made myself into something I never thought I would be. I was the fundraiser. I brought in some guys that had MBAs. They knew something about finance, nothing about buyouts, but something about finance. And I said, I'll raise the money, and I had to go raise it. I raised $5 million in the first time when I started, and then we later built it to a firm that now has got about $450 billion. But and I spent a lot of time running around the world. But I must say, to be honest, this is the first time I've ever been here. So there must not be any sovereign wealth funds in this island. I go where there's a lot of money, sovereign wealth funds, pension funds, but nobody ever brought me here. So I'm sorry not to have been here before.
You would have made a great dentist. So let's talk about your books, because, you know, you've devoted so much to explaining and fighting literacy problems, and you have supported so many libraries and institutions, cultural institutions. And then you plunged into writing books, and they were a result of all the work you'd done exposing people to other books. So what made you decide to actually become an author?
Well, of course, books tend to live longer than the people that write them, right? So there's some legacy, I guess. But what happened was this, and you know, some of you may have seen I have some TV shows that do interviewing. And the reason I enjoy it is because, when you get older and, you know, let's say over the age of 50 maybe, or whatever it is, you always worry, is your brain going away or something like that? So I always worried my brain going to collapse. That's my best feature, is my brain, I thought. It's not my body, obviously. So it's my brain. And, you know, you always wonder, how are you going to keep your brain sharp? Now, if you have a genetic predisposition to Alzheimer's or dementia, not much you can do about it. But if you don't, you can do certain things. You can do crossword puzzles, they say. You can learn a foreign language. You could do musical instrument. I can't do crossword puzzles. I've never been good at that. I'm tone deaf, so I can't play a musical instrument, and I'm not that good at foreign languages. So I decided, well, I got to find something. And then what happened was this. At Carlisle, to get people to come to our events, we have 1,000 people coming, but I want to make sure they show up. I would hire famous people, the former presidents of the United States, and pay them a large fee, and they would come and make a speech, but they were often boring. And so I say, I'm paying you $400,000, but the audience is bored. So I sent it a speaking agent. Would you mind if I interview them? Maybe I could use some humor or something, make it more interesting. And they said, as long as the fee's the same, we don't care. So I started, and I made Hillary Clinton look very funny. I made Ben Bernanke look exciting. And so I started realizing I could do this. And then I became the head of the Economic Club of Washington. And I started the same problem. I brought business people in to speak. They were terrible, terrible. And so I said, I'll stop this and I'll interview them. And Bloomberg saw it and they put it on TV. And I like doing it because you can keep your brain sharp. You have to prepare and so forth. And I like doing that. And you know, it's just, you know, it kept me kind of intellectually engaged with things. So I think interviewing now, it turns out everybody is an interviewer because, you know, there should be a bumper sticker. Honk if you don't have your own podcast. Everybody has a podcast.
That's true.
And so one of the books I'm hoping to write soon is How to Be an Interviewer and How to Be an Interviewee. And one of the lessons I learned from about interviewing was from Oprah Winfrey. I interviewed her once on a show, and I said, well, you're a really great interviewer. She said, no, I'm not a good interviewer. I'm a good listener. You know, the key to being a good interviewer, she said, is listening. And it reminded me, like when an FBI agent comes by and wants to do a background check on somebody, they have a 10-point list of things that they ask you about. And I could say the person is an axe murderer. Let me give you the details. They say, we don't have time. We go on to the next question. So they don't listen. You have to listen to what the person says and follow up. And so I kind of enjoy it. And I kind of thought I would take some of my interviews and put them in the books. And, you know, the good thing about a book is you have to focus your brain for a while. You have to get some solitude to actually do it. And you have something that, you know, you can give to your grandchildren. I have four grandchildren. They're all not yet reading, really. So I give them the books, and they don't really seem upset about it, but they don't really know what a book is yet. So maybe they'll read it someday. My children might actually read my book someday, too.
So I want to talk about your books, because now you've written How to Invest, The American Experiment, How to Lead, The American Story, and now The Highest Calling. And there's a theme here. There is a very definite theme, and it's about leadership. And so my question to you is the notion of leadership in this country, so important, and never so important as it is now, what made you want to write this book? It's in the introduction. You should all read the book's introduction.
This wasn't on the presidents. I interviewed most of the living presidents, and then I interviewed Donald Trump. He gave me an interview. He was about to go on trial that afternoon. He gave me the interview in the morning. And I interviewed Joe Biden in the Oval Office and interviewed Bill Clinton. I interviewed George W. Bush. And then I interviewed experts. One of the experts is here. Where's Ted Widmer? Ted, there. Okay, I interviewed him about Lincoln. And it's a great story. He wrote this incredible book about how Lincoln had to stop 66 times on his way to Washington because he wanted to get better known, but also he couldn't take the train through the South. He would have probably been assassinated. And my hometown of Baltimore, there was a plot to have him assassinated as well. It's a great book about...
Beautiful book.
About Lincoln. That's in the book. But what I wanted to do is I got criticized by some people because I had said for many years, the highest calling of mankind is private equity. And, you know, so I decided to switch a bit and say this was the highest calling. And the reason is this, and I tried to start the book this way. When the Congress created the presidency, it wasn't an afterthought, but it wasn't thought to be the most important job. For example, the Article 1 of the Constitution is not the presidency, it's the Congress. So Article 2 was the president, and they didn't really know what the president was going to be, and so in the end, when they had about 2 or 3 days to go, they created a committee, it called, wonderfully named, Committee on Unfinished Parts. And the unfinished parts were what to make of the president. So he finally came out of the unfinished committee parts and said, all right, you can have unlimited terms. Each term is 4 years, wasn't a term limit. And it was pretty much known that George Washington would be the president, and that's why they made him also commander-in-chief. But in the early days, the president wasn't that powerful, to be honest. We were a small country of 3 million people, and there was a very small number of people who were allowed to be in government, because when the country started, when the Revolutionary War, we had 3 million people. 500,000 were slaves. They couldn't be in government. And then you had 1.5 million women, or 1.25 million women, white women, who couldn't be in government either. They weren't allowed to be in government. And then you had some Christian non-property-owning men. You didn't own property, you couldn't be in government. You had 10,000 Jews in 1776. They were not allowed to be in government either. So you had about 400,000 people It is amazing that we got George Washington, out of just 400,000 people, George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, Benjamin Franklin. Where are those leaders? We now are a country, we had 3 million people and about half of them couldn't be in government. Now, out of 330 million people, we have not George Washington and so forth. Where have all these people gone? My theory is they've all gone into private equity and hedge funds. But what really happened is that in the early days, the presidency wasn't that important. It was important, but not global figures. Not until Woodrow Wilson wanted to solve the World War I by going to Paris. He went for 6 months, back and forth, 6 months. And when he went to Paris the first time, when he showed up in Paris, the first time a sitting president of the United States had gone overseas, he was cheered by hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people in Paris. And it was the recognition, really, I thought, of the fact that the president of the United States is now the most important person in the world. And clearly, ever since Wilson, with very few exceptions, the president of the United States is by far the most important person in the world. And so why do people want this job? Well, it's the most important job in the world, though. Think about it. John Kennedy, assassinated. Lyndon Johnson, driven out of office. Richard Nixon, forced out of office as well. Gerald Ford couldn't get reelected. Jimmy Carter couldn't get reelected. Ronald Reagan almost thrown out of office and almost assassinated. George Herbert Walker Bush didn't get reelected. Bill Clinton impeached. So you have to say to yourself, why do people want to humiliate themselves for 2 years, run around, beg for money, beg for votes, eat terrible food, not exercise, not see your family? It's because the job is, in the end, the most important job in the world, and a lot of ambitious people who want to be leaders want the most important job in the world. That's why people obsess over it. And so many people want this job. You can't imagine how many people are already lining up for the next presidential election, because if you're president of the United States, you've got all the power in the world, and now more and more than ever, I think.
It's such a wonderful book to read right through, because it goes all the way from George Washington to Donald Trump. And there, it's knit so beautifully, because one suggests the next in a way. And so I want to ask you, having spent so much time talking about the presidency and talking to people who have devoted their lives to writing about presidents, which presidents stand out to you as the most admirable?
What presidents?
What presidents stand out as the most admirable?
Well, not even close. The greatest president of the United States, without doubt. I'm not even sure who's second, probably Washington, but it's Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln is barely elected. He got, 39% of the vote. He wasn't even on the ballot in many southern states. In my home state of Maryland, he got 2,000 votes. And yet he came with no college education, no real school education. He was a gangly person, had a complicated marriage, and yet he was determined to hold the country together. Many people in the North in those days said, if the Southerners want to take their slavery and have their own country, let them go. Goodbye. But that wasn't his view. His view was, we had a constitution, the country was supposed to be one country, and he fought, and we lost 3% of our population, but he kept the country together. And also, on January 1 of 1863, he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, which freed the slaves in certain states, and that led to the 13th Amendment. And that really got rid of didn't eliminate discrimination. Obviously, Jim Crow laws came along, and Reconstruction didn't work because Lincoln was assassinated. But he did end slavery and did make former slaves citizens eligible to vote. And it was his decision that maybe some African-Americans freed as slaves would be able to vote that upset John Wilkes Booth and led him to assassinate him. And that could have been prevented, in my view, because what happened was Abraham Lincoln toured the South with his wife one day at the end of the war, and with him was Julia Grant and Ulysses S. Grant, the great general who had been the first general that actually worked for Lincoln. Lincoln had terrible generals. They didn't work. They didn't fight hard. And then finally he gave the job to Ulysses S. Grant, who was widely known to be an alcoholic. And his advisors came to him and said, you can't give it to this man who's an alcoholic. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, find out what he's drinking and give it to all the other generals, because he was the best general. So they tour the Northern Virginia, and Mrs. Grant sat down apparently on a boat before Mrs. Lincoln came in and sat down herself. But Mrs. Lincoln berated her. And afterwards, Mrs. Grant said, I don't want to be around this woman again. 2 days later, President Lincoln invites Ulysses S. Grant to come to see our American cousin at Ford's Theater with Mrs. Lincoln. And Mrs. Grant said, we got to get out of this. We got to make an excuse. So they decided to make a trip to go visit their son in New Jersey. Had Grant been with Lincoln that day, he had his usual 20 military people around him. It's very unlikely that John Wilkes Booth could have gotten in and shot him, but you never know. In any event, Lincoln also, he had one trait that I really admire, which was humility. When he signed the Emancipation Proclamation, which was an executive order, he didn't hold it up and show it around. You know, he just signed it and that was it. He never bragged about himself. Can you see him walking around the White House saying, you know, I just did the Gettysburg Address. I wrote it by myself. Pretty good, right? You just can't see him do it. So for his humility and for what he did to hold the country together, and he gave his life for the country, assassinated at the age of 56, he's by far the greatest president. George Washington, the second, because he got the country off the ground. Had anybody else who had won a war, as Washington did, would probably have become a king or a dictator, and Washington was admired for not doing that. And so, and by stepping down, he could have turned it over to a relative or something. He stepped down and walked away. So he was our second greatest president, without doubt, in my view.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's show is the first in a six-part series of conversations recorded at the 2025 College of the Atlantic's Summer Institute. The theme of this year's series is Leadership and Pathbreakers. Today's episode was recorded live on July 29th and has been edited for broadcast. Stay with us as Marie Arana continues her interview with David Rubenstein.
So you also seem to like Ike, Eisenhower. Eisenhower seems to appeal to you.
Eisenhower, when I was a boy, some of you maybe my age may have the same view, I said, this man is dull. I was watching on TV, he was bald, dull. I couldn't understand what he was saying. And I, you know, thought he was also too old. I looked it up recently. He was elected president when he was 62. He finished when he was 70. I'm older than 70 now. So again, it looks like a teenager. Eisenhower was 52 years old and a colonel in the military. He had missed combat in World War I for a lot of complicated reasons, and he basically had no combat experience. Yet he was selected ultimately by George Marshall, who was then Army Chief of Staff, to be the person who was ultimately going to be possibly the general who would lead our effort in Normandy and in conquering Europe again, though it could have been George Marshall. But Eisenhower did it, and he didn't have any combat experience, so they put him in charge of Northern Africa for a while, where he did pretty well. Then they put him in charge of Italy, where he did pretty well. Then he was ready for the invasion of Europe, and he got along well with people. He was very good at massaging other people, particularly dealing with big egos like Churchill or like FDR. So he did this job, and had he never become president of the United States, he would have done a great service for the country, winning the war in a way that other people weren't sure we were going to do. And then one of the great things he did was not only the invasion, he was prepared, as we all now know, to take the blame. If it didn't work out, he was going to take the blame. He prepared a little sentence saying, I'm sorry it didn't work out. It's all my fault. Fortunately, he didn't have to issue that. But when he got into Europe, and he went to Europe, and he went to Germany, he saw the concentration camps. And he said, this is unbelievable. People won't believe this. It's so dastardly. He brought camera crews over from the United States. He brought camera crews over from the rest of Europe. And they photographed it so that people theoretically wouldn't be able to say the Holocaust didn't exist. And then he didn't want to be president. He really was not political. Truman offered him the Democratic nomination in 1948. He didn't want it. He could have had the Democratic nomination in 1952. He didn't want it. In the last minute, he decided to run in 1952 only because the man who was going to get the nomination, Republican Party, Robert Taft, when he met with Eisenhower, he wouldn't agree that he would support NATO, he wouldn't support the United Nations and things like that. And so Eisenhower just said, well, we have to be more international. And he ran, got the nomination, won overwhelmingly. And while I thought it was dull at the time, we kept the peace. He kept the peace. We had pretty good prosperity. And we got our satellite system building and our space program off the ground. And he did one other thing that people don't pay attention to. When he was a colonel and a young colonel in the Army, young colonel, maybe even a below colonel, there was a test on whether you could actually travel from the East Coast to the West Coast of the United States because the roads weren't so great. They wanted to know how long it took. it would take. So he did this. He had a couple trucks with him and so forth, and they wanted to see how you could traverse the country. It took him 3 months. 3 months to drive from the East Coast to the West Coast. And it's sort of in the back of his head, we got to have a better highway system. So he built the interstate highway system without any federal appropriations, obviously uses tax, gas tax money. So that was one of his great contributions. And I think he also, he was an example of what is great in this country, a citizen who gives up what they have to be president. He didn't need to be president. He wasn't lusting after it, but he really wanted to give back to the country. And it's an incredible story. His parents were German descendants, and his parents were pacifists. So think about this. Eisenhower is leading the war against Germany. His ancestors were German, and his parents are pacifists. Yet he did this because he thought it was the right thing to do. So I think Eisenhower deserves a lot of credit, though he hadn't gotten as much as I think he deserves.
So you watched JFK go by in a car, and then you have known pretty much the majority of presidents who followed him. You have known Jimmy Carter and all the presidents who followed. What is your estimation of those, the ones that you knew? Can you give us some personal feedback, anecdotes, feelings about those presidents?
Jimmy Carter was a very smart man. It's amazing he became president because he was a one-term governor of Georgia. Wasn't that popular? Couldn't have been reelected if reelection was possible in those days, only one term. And he had no money. And he would go out and stay in people's homes, not because he wanted to meet more people, because he couldn't afford hotels. It's amazing that he came from nothing and willed himself into the presidency. Obviously, he was inexperienced. He was only 52 when he became president. I think he would have gotten reelected had we not had the hostages. And the hostages was something he didn't want to do. He didn't want to let the Shah into the country. He was lobbied heavily by Henry Kissinger. David Rockefeller was part of it. And also Zbigniew Brzezinski. There was a group of people, and John McCloy. They all really thought that the Shah was a great friend of the United States and he should be allowed in. Carter resisted it. Finally, he gave up. And it turns out that the Shah could have gotten the cancer treatment at Mexico with the same thing that they had at Sloan Kettering. Many came in that lived in the hostages, and we naively thought that they would prefer Carter to get the credit for releasing the hostages and not Reagan. But and Carter, had he not had the hostages, and inflation was high too, he would have been reelected, but he wasn't. I would say he was followed by Reagan was the television script is perfect. I mean, he could give a speech. It was so great. He would give great speeches. He was an actor in many ways. Jim Baker, who was in my firm for many years, would say he would go into the Oval Office. He was chief of staff the first term. And he would say, and Reagan would say at the beginning, "Well, boys, what are we going to do today?" And, like it was a script. He would give them the script, and he would do it, go through the day, and he would, very happy. He had some problems toward the end, probably because of Iran-Contra and other things. But he looked the part. He was many ways. He changed the country in ways we thought would make the country much more conservative. Today, he looks like a moderate. He was succeeded by George Herbert Walker Bush, who would join my firm after he retired as president. He became an advisor to us, and I got to know him. He's the nicest human I've ever met, the nicest, most considerate man I ever met in my entire life. Such a polite person. And remember, after the Kuwait War, people thought he would get reelected so easily, and then he just didn't because he increased taxes and so forth. But just an incredible person. And then Bill Clinton may be the smartest IQ-wise of the presidents that I've known, because he not only was very, very cerebral, but he could connect the dots in ways that I haven't seen many people do. You could talk about A, B, and C, and he could bring it all together in a way that very few people can do. We obviously had some personal issues that were problems, but very, very cerebral. And remember, he's an example of somebody who won the first third of life. He's the only president we've had in 100 plus years who you might have said would be a president when he was in high school or college. Most of our presidents had no background that you would think they would get qualified to be president of the United States, but he was one of the few, maybe the only one. And then, George W. Bush, I didn't take him that seriously when I knew him first time. He was involved with some things that I was involved with, and I remember he told his mother he was going to run for governor, and his mother said, "Well, George, you have no chance of winning." And so, if you may remember the election, his parents chartered a plane to fly from Texas to be at Jeb Bush's victory celebration. He was running for governor of Florida. And George said to them, well, what about me? Aren't you coming to mind? He said, George, you're going to lose. And so it turned out Jeb Bush lost and George won. And how did he get to be president? Because, you know, the governor of Texas has very limited power. The state legislature meets only 90 days every other year. You can't do much. And all the cabinet is appointed by the lieutenant governor. But why did George W. Bush was so highly ranked? Well, after he got reelected, they started asking people, who would you like to see as a Republican nominee? And George Bush was overwhelmingly the choice of Republican voters. Why would that be? But it turns out if you read the internals of the polling, 70% or so of the people thought they were saying George Herbert Walker Bush. But, and the reason he's not George Herbert Walker Bush Jr. is this. I asked George Bush once, why didn't you name your son the same thing, a junior? Why'd you name him George W. Bush? Where's the H? He said, when I was a little boy in Greenwich, I had two middle names. Everybody made fun of me all the time. The two middle names, I said I would never do that to my son. That's why I was George W. In terms of after George W., Barack Obama, I got to know him a bit, and very cerebral, very intelligent person. I obviously, who would have predicted an African-American person would get elected president of the United States? And he's one of the few people who served as president of the United States and had no scandals. I mean, what kind of president can you be if you don't have a scandal? No scandals. Very cerebral person, and you know, when unfortunately, from his point of view, his obituary is going to say the lead sentence is first African American elected president of the United States. He did a lot of things, but that is what he'll be most remembered for, in addition to Obamacare. And then Donald Trump. You know, I knew Donald Trump a little bit. Let me tell you one Donald Trump story. Anybody want to hear a Donald Trump story?
Absolutely.
So my parents, when they retired in Baltimore, they moved to a suburb of Baltimore called West Palm Beach, Florida. And when they moved there, every time I have a family anniversary or something, I would rent a place for a big event, and my kids and so forth, and family, friends, and I would rent the place called Mar-a-Lago. I wasn't a member, but you just could show up with a credit card. You could rent. It was like any hotel. So every time I'm doing there, a tall man with orange hair would come around and kind of be in our family photos. And I didn't really know who he was originally, but I figured it out. And he said he knew who I was, and I didn't want to say, well, he said he admired my firm. I didn't want to say he'd sued us three times, but I didn't want to say that. So I got to know him. And then one time, as the head of the Economic Club of Washington, I'm looking for speakers and somebody I can interview. Somebody said, why don't you invite Donald Trump? I said, well, he's not the most successful real estate developer in New York, and this is the Economic Club of Washington. They said, but he's got a TV show called The Apprentice. I'd never seen it. I'd heard of it, but I'd never seen it. They said, it's very popular. So I invited him. He wrote back right away, yes, I'll be there. So he came down in the green room. He said, this is December 2014. David, ask me anything you want. Thanks for inviting me, but ask me two questions for sure. One, ask me if I'm going to run for president. And I said, president of what? And he said, president of the United States. I said, Donald, you're not going to be president of the United States. He said, I know, but it'll help my brand. That's what he said. Second, ask me if my hair is real and pull my hair. You show people it's real. I said, geez, I don't know if I'm really comfortable pulling your hair, but I'll ask you about it. Anyway, we had the interview, called me next day and said, David, it's the best interview I ever had. And I want to make you an honorary member of Mar-a-Lago, which he did, was rescinded later, but he did make it for a while. And then he said, this is the highest rated show in the 40-year history of C-SPAN. It was covered live by C-SPAN. And I called Brian Lamb, who's the head of C-SPAN, and said, what were the ratings? He said, we don't have ratings. So, but Donald Trump, to be very serious, I thought after the first term that the closest analogy to what his situation was Napoleon in Elba. Remember, when Napoleon was thrown out of France, he was initially put in Elba, an island from which they didn't think he could escape. And he did escape, and he came back and ran France again. I thought Donald Trump was in the same situation. He had no chance of being president again. Obviously, I was wrong, and I just couldn't believe it. Today, whatever you think of him, rightly or wrongly, or whatever you like or don't like, he's got more power than any president we've ever had. Of the 47 presidents, we've never had a president who controls the executive branch, lock, stock, and barrel, as much as he does. There's no independent agencies that he has to worry about. He has complete control over the executive branch. He has complete control right now of the Senate and the House, getting almost anything he wants through. And then he pretty much has control of the Supreme Court. He's got pretty much 4 to 5 votes for almost anything he wants. So we've never had a president, even Roosevelt at his peak or Lincoln at his peak, didn't have this kind of power. So it's an unusual situation. I won't go into the merits of all the things that have happened, but I would just say it's amazing he's pulled it off. He's got greater political skills than any president we've ever had, because look at the power he's accrued, rightly or wrongly, but it's an amazing feat he has, and, you know, we'll see what happens from here on.
Joe Biden.
I forgot Biden. I'm sorry. On Biden, I knew him when he was first. He was the first United States senator to endorse Jimmy Carter. So I got to know him a long time ago when he was, remember, he ran for the Senate when he was elected when he was 29. He served when he was 30. He was running against Caleb Boggs, the senator who he said was too old at 65. Biden, I think, actually did a pretty good job of getting done what he said he was going to do. I think many people thought he would do one term and then he would want to step back. But, you know, it's intoxicating. When you're president of the United States, people don't like to give it up. It's an incredible job. People, you know, hail to the chief when you walk in the room. People tell you how great you are all the time, or most of the time. And so I think he also felt that Donald Trump, if he got elected again, would be bad for the country. So he decided to run, leaving aside the criticisms that you can make of it. Biden actually got a number of things done. Inflation got out of control a bit, but mostly because we spent $5 trillion under Trump and Biden dealing with COVID. And that what we didn't raise taxes to deal with it. And then they didn't recognize how significant the inflation was going to be. But the CHIPS Act, I think, will be a good bill. And I think the infrastructure bill was good. And, you know, so I think in the end, Biden will not go down in history as a great president, because in our country, you're considered a great president if you get reelected. You have to get reelected. George Herbert Walker Bush won't be seen great, or Jimmy Carter, because he didn't get reelected. But Biden, I did some good things, but obviously he's got a lot of issues today, and his health is not as good as we would all like it to be. But I regard him as an honest man, and I went in to do the interview for the book, and I did it alone with him for an hour, and we recorded it, and then there were no handlers or anything. But, you know, a lot of books have now come out about his situation. I'm not expert enough to comment on it, but my impression from talking to a lot of people in the White House staff was that, you know, if you focused him a couple hours a day, he would make the right decisions, and he could focus on it and do the right things. Was he able to go across the Atlantic back and forth a couple times and not get jet lag? Well, obviously that was a problem, but think about it. He was 81, 82 years old. How many of you, 81 or 82, think you could do what he was doing? So it was a challenge, but in the end, I think he was an honest guy, and I think he did a reasonably good job.
Let's play a game. Yeah. Let's play a game. If we anointed you with special powers and you could bring back whatever president you wanted, and number one, to rule again, and number two, to have dinner with, and would they be the same or would they be different?
Well, that's an interesting question in this sense. The interview format that we're now engaging in is a relatively new format. While I was kidding about everybody has a podcast, 100 years ago, there were no interviews. There's never been an interview of Abraham Lincoln. There was no interviews of George Washington. And with artificial intelligence, and I've thought about working with artificial intelligence to see whether we could come up with interviews of Abraham Lincoln, interviews of George Washington. And think about all the people you'd love to see interviewed. You ask William Shakespeare, who really wrote those plays? Or Henry VIII, why didn't you get a prenup with your wife instead of chopping off their heads? Or ask Cleopatra, who was a better lover, Mark Antony or Julius Caesar? These are the things we want to know, and maybe with artificial intelligence we'll get it. But if I could have dinner with any president, without doubt, Abraham Lincoln. He was a great storyteller, but also admire what he did and how he came from nothing. And his wife, there's a play in New York, some of you may have seen, Oh Mary, which kind of makes fun of his wife. You know, his wife had lots of problems, and her oldest son committed her to a mental institution after Lincoln died. But think about this. They had 4 boys. One died before they went to the White House. One died while they were at the White House. One died shortly after Lincoln was assassinated and her husband was assassinated. So how many people would be sane after their husband is assassinated and the 3 of their children die early? So she had some problems, but, you know, some of it's fairly understandable. But if I could have dinner with, you know, him, he'd be great. I think Reagan might be the best storyteller. You want to listen to good stories. Reagan had great stories. George Washington, just ask him, you know, like they say, what about those teeth? Where did you get those teeth? They were not wooden teeth, actually. But so I hope that someday we'll have a woman be president. And we came close. It is amazing when you think about it. I'm about to do something I did a speech over the weekend about Jackie Kennedy, who's incredible what she did at the White House. Think about this. How many of you can believe how young she was? She's First Lady of the United States at the age of 31. She organized the incredible funeral that we all remember at the age of 34. and she redid the White House and then got the Mona Lisa lent to the United States government, preserved buildings in Lafayette Park, and did incredible things, and had to raise two children. And she died at such a tragic young age. She was only 64.
Amazing.
So, you know, in the end, we will probably have a woman first lady, as president. And I don't know when, but I'm sure, I hope it's in my lifetime. But I think we'll have a woman president before we have a Jewish president.
From your lips to God's ears.
We'll see.
Yeah, absolutely. So before I open it up to questions from you, from the audience, I want to ask you for a 3-4 minute, that he does this splendidly, State of the Union. Current State of the Union.
Well, look, we have 50 million immigrants, as I said, in this country. The country with the second most immigrants is Germany, with about 5 or 6 million. People still want to come to this country because we generally have the rule of law. Obviously, there's some times when you can question whether the rule of law is as good as you might want it to be. But we have a lot of freedoms, rights, opportunities in this country to do things that you probably can't do in other countries. I think the economy right now is in reasonably good shape. The tariffs are a bit of a confusing kind of thing for the business community and everybody else. It's obviously a tax, so it's kind of inflationary. And unfortunately, we're stuck with the tariffs now because the big, beautiful bill assumed there'd be a lot of tariff money coming in for the next 10 years, because if we didn't, the deficit would go up by another $2 trillion. So I do worry about the debt and the deficit we have. We have a staggering amount of debt, staggering deficit. We have about $38 trillion of debt, an annual deficit of about $2 trillion, not sustainable. And the result is ultimately the dollar will probably weaken. That's a problem. I also think we have a problem in this country with a lack of social mobility. People at the bottom don't really feel they can get to the top anymore, and maybe they can't, because we have a lot of high school dropout rate is high. As I mentioned, the illiteracy rate is high, and the crime rate is demographically related, but it's high crime rate in certain cities. But you know, I wouldn't move to any other country or live in any other country with this country with our warts and everything else. But clearly, there's a lot of challenges right now, and what's going on in Washington makes a lot of people nervous. There's no doubt about it.
Are you an optimist or a pessimist?
Well, if you're in the investment world, you have to be an optimist because you have to assume that most things are going to work out for the good. But I would say I'm generally an optimist. You know, if you've lived the life I've lived and you're a pessimist, it wouldn't make sense. If you think everything's going to fall apart, you can't do anything, you're not going to get out of bed in the morning. So, you know, the trick is in life is to try to find something you enjoy and pursue it and make yourself happy. And let me just end with the happiness thing. On happiness, Thomas Jefferson wrote a sentence that became the most famous sentence in the English language, and Walter Isaacson's coming out with a book in November on that sentence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But in the ensuing 50 years that he lived, he died the same day as John Adams, 50 years later, he never actually defined happiness. And happiness has many different definitions, but presumably what we all want out of life is to have a happy life. If you're a parent, have happy and healthy children, and to live a long life with some health.
Shall we have some questions about either this book or David in general? I see somebody over there.
Yeah, thank you. You've made a fair number of comments about age. There's minimum ages to be elected to Congress, the Senate, or presidency. Do you think there should be a maximum age? And if so, what do you think that should be?
Well, the minimum age for the House is 25, for the Senate is 30, and for the presidency is 35. I would say it's unlikely. You'd have to have a constitutional amendment, very hard to get. You need two-thirds of each House and three-quarters of the Senate. So I'm three-quarters of the states and two-thirds of each House, so I'm not likely to get done. But I would say, you know, the business community, generally has a guideline that probably most of their senior executives of most of these companies, unless they're founder-owned companies, tend to probably age you out at 70 or so. Obviously, some people at Warren Buffett in his early 90s was as sharp as a tack and is very sharp. It depends. So I would say it wouldn't be my highest priority because it would be too difficult to get that changed. So I would rather spend my energy on something else. But I would say if something between 70 and 75 wouldn't be the end of the earth, in my view. But obviously, you know, we have our current president who's 79, and And if he lives out his term, he'll be 83 at the end, and he could legally serve another term. I can explain that if you care, but anyway.
Thank you. Another question?
Thank you so much for this. This has been fascinating and very amusing, too. I have spent my career in Washington, D.C. Unfortunately, I didn't get the memo on private equity, so I didn't do that, as that is the highest calling. But I've always felt that politics is a lot like fashion, that what comes next is a reaction to what's come before. And Marie, you mentioned in the book, which I haven't read, but I have purchased and look forward to reading, that you really knit together and understand how each president sort of sets up the next. So I'm going to ask you to prognosticate or predict. How is this presidency setting up the next presidency, and what do you expect in the next presidency?
The next president? Well, yes. A couple of things. If you try to predict who the next president is going to be 3 years in advance, you'll be wrong all the time. Because if you go back, and I did recently for a piece I wrote, the last 20 presidential elections, 3 years in advance, if you look at who was predicted to be the next president, you'd be wrong. And even the next nominee. Nobody would have predicted 3 years in advance Barack Obama, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, so forth. I think most presidents want to have a legacy that continues their policies. And so Donald Trump is no different than any other president. He would like to have his policies continued. So how is he going to do that? Well, he's got to remain popular, so he's got to win the midterms so he doesn't have to deal with Congress. And the midterms could go either way. A president usually loses 25 seats in the House of Representatives in the first midterm. Trump lost 40 the first time. Bill Clinton lost 54 seats. Barack Obama lost 62 seats. So it's too hard to know what now how the House will go. But if Trump can, he'll put a lot of money into the House campaign. If he can control the House and keep that and keep the Senate, then he can eventually pick his successor. And I would say today there are a couple people jockeying for it. Usually the people that jockey for it don't get it. But obviously the vice president is, I think, not uninterested, I think it's fair to say. I would say the Secretary of State has run before, and he would be not uninterested as well. There's another candidate who's got the last name Trump, Donald Trump Jr., and, you know, people say from time to time he might be interested. I don't know. But a president wants to pick his successor because that person will continue his policies. And it really gets down to many of the things you're seeing now in Washington will be obliterated if a Democrat gets in. In my view, they'll be changed. A lot of the things that you now are maybe upset with will be changed. But if Trump gets his chosen successor to be in there, what policy we have now will probably continue. I don't think anybody has the ability that Trump does to get members to do what they want, what he wants as much as he does. But in terms of, I should have made it clear how he could run for president himself again, and I'll just explain it to people. When Roosevelt had his fourth term, the Republicans were very upset. So they got a constitutional amendment through that called the 21st Amendment. And the 21st Amendment basically says that a person can be elected president twice, and that's it, served twice. However, it was poorly drafted, and so Donald Trump could be elected vice president under anybody, and then that president resigns in the first minute, Donald Trump becomes president. That would be legal, and obviously a friend of his, Putin, did it as well one time. So that's how he could do it, but I think my impression is that he feels at 83 years old, he'll probably be at enough. And, you know, it's hard at 83 to want to do four more years of the White House. And so I think he wouldn't do that. But I think the chosen successors are likely to be one of those three people, though the Secretary of Interior, Doug Burgum, is also probably seriously interested in running as well. But you just don't know. Somebody will come out of the woodwork we never heard of before.
David, thank you so much for coming to the Summer Institute. Thank you.
You've been listening to philanthropist David Rubenstein and author Marie Arana on Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program was the first in a six-part series from the 2025 College of the Atlantic Summer Institute. This talk was recorded July 29, 2025, in Bar Harbor, Maine. Today's episode is available on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on Shows to find Speaking in Maine and many other on-demand programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and today's program was produced by me, Jane Donahue. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.